Welcome to the latest Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan, where it's bright and sunny finally.
And hot. Why is it hot?
No, it's good. No. The weather has turned amazing, and that's very relevant to the topic today.
That's true. There are some good things to be said about the summer.
Fine.
My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
Today we are talking about light, fun stuff. Outdoor tubs.
I don't know about you, but my experience has been that tubs are heavy, so.
That's good. Setting the tone.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to learning a lot on this episode. This is something that I have sort of attempted once, so.
It's pretty fun, and it's pretty cool.
There are a lot of people getting really excited about this season just so that they can do this.
Yeah. My first experience with it was really just, I have a pretty fun backyard pond. It's not huge. It's in the, 1,500 to 2,000 gallon range, which as far as ponds go, that's not huge. It's decent size. And I thought, well, somebody said, what do you do about mosquitoes? You should put some little fish in there to take care of the mosquitoes. So, hey, that's a good idea. So I put in a half a dozen platys and a half a dozen zebra danios. And I pulled out, I'm going to say hundreds and hundreds at the end of the season. Put them in May. And from September all the way into October, I was pulling out hundreds and hundreds of the best zebra danios and platys I've ever seen.
You can really tell a tub bred fish when they start coming in the fall. They look better.
They do. Better color, better size, chunkier. Mm-hmm. The zebra danios, they were blue and gold, black and white. They were amazing. They were gorgeous and big. I pulled out a platy female that had to be 3 inches long.
Yeah, and I think there is something to the idea that like sunlight tans fish almost the way that it does with us, but also just the level of health that you get out of fish like that and the natural, survival of the fittest.
I think it's food.
You think it's just food? It's
sunlight and food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I definitely think it's food.
Yeah.
There's going to get into a not really heavy into it, but there's a lot of chemistry about enzymes that they're not very long lasting. And so with live food, like they haven't had time to degrade.
Right. Sort of like fresh veggies versus canned veggies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's true. So we're kind of going to outline this talk, very structured how we usually do it. By the way, that's a total lie. A loose outline is going to be, we're going to talk about some of the setup ideas. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk about some of the advantages and some of the challenges. And then we're going to talk about some of the creatures that work well in there.
Sounds like fun.
Does that work right along with the detailed notes you guys took on this topic?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think we can make that work.
Okay, good. So let's start with setup. Like I said, the first time I did it, it was not really a tub idea, but it was more like I stuck some extra fish in my little garden pond.
Yours is like a pond.
It's a pond. Yeah. I have koi and goldfish in it and water lilies and plants and stuff like that.
Did you have koi and goldfish when you were breeding little fish in it?
I did.
Really?
It didn't matter. Still had hundreds. I just had koi, I had no goldfish.
Oh, I guess probably I can see that. Like, they probably were too small for the koi to even really notice.
It probably was 5 or 6 4-inch, chain store koi.
Okay.
Yeah. It may have been a number of years ago.
But more common would be a literal tub, right?
Yes. So the ones that I see a lot of the club members doing, and I've done it as well, are either those round planter size tubs that are about 20 to 25 gallons. Or the Rubbermaid 75 or 100 gallon oval shaped tubs.
I know a few people, including myself, who use like a lined whiskey half barrels.
Oh yeah, that would work.
Yeah.
Theoretically, anything that can be outside and hold water without, falling apart.
And be big enough for the fish.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's go basic, right? So the planters, I think Hagen actually makes a really nice line of these planter thingies that are about 20 inches, 22 inches in diameter, and about 14 inches deep. And I think like they're designed that you could put a little teeny fountain and a lily pad in there. And it would be great. But it also works really well for this.
I've seen some people use aquaponic like tubs because they'll be like 6 feet by 6 feet by like 12 inches. And so you get a lot of surface area without a lot of depth.
That stuff is great.
And it would still look kind of like a pond, you know, and without being necessarily dug into the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times it's easier to not dig these into the ground because of the risk of predators. But we'll get to that with the... No, let's talk about it now. What the heck? So if it's harder for raccoons to get into it, well, then it's harder for raccoons to get into it and your fish do better.
Yeah, you don't really want them to be able to wade into the shallows of your...
Yeah, that can be problematic. Yeah. But okay, so let's start with... So here's some of the advantages of doing this, right? The first one is it's easy and it's cheap. Mm-hmm. First ones, because there was two there. So those Rubbermaid tubs, there's a $75 version of them at Tractor Supply. That's like 110 gallons. That's cheap, 110 gallons.
Oh yeah, you can't get an aquarium for nearly that cheap.
Yeah. That, a sponge filter and an air pump, and you're breeding fish. And you're breeding tons of fish.
But Ben, do you need a filter?
Depends on the fish. I have definitely seen some killifish and gouramis done without any kind of filter.
I've done bettas.
Bettas, perfect. Any anabantoid would be perfect for that. Yeah. You know, look at where what water the fish comes from. If the fish comes from gently moving water, you probably want gently moving water. If the fish comes from water that can be pretty still, you're probably good without a filter.
Yeah, I did have, and I guess right now is a really good time to bring it up. I had one point I want to make sure it was said in this. I personally don't think that pumps in a lot of situations are not necessary, but a lot of people want them because they want the little, you know, fountain and stuff, and that's fine. I will advise that if you do that, make sure that if the like little tower tilts in a direction, it's not spraying out of the pond, and that I would also recommend putting it on like the pump itself on top of a brick or something, so it's raised off the bottom. So if something weird happens, worst, like the pump is going to die in a situation like that, but you might be able to save your fish if you still have some water.
Yeah, true. Some of the people that are really getting into it, some of the real cool setups that I've seen is they'll put a shelf in their garage and they'll put the tubs right outside their garage and actually put the air pump in the garage and drill a little hole.
Oh, that's
and
smart.
And run the air line into the tub that way so that the air line and all the electricity or the air pump and the electricity is all inside and covered and protected from the elements.
Well, yeah, having to get power out to it would definitely be one of the biggest challenges of... figuring out where to place it, figuring out what you can fit. So you can still do it without running power, right? In certain situations.
For sure. For sure. One of the big questions I get out there has to do with light. Mm-hmm. People are always talking about, well, I need a good sunny spot, right? Completely the opposite.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good time to talk about my half-hearted attempt at it because I had... a few too many plants one spring and I just happened to have one of these tubs around. Like, okay, let me throw those out there and see what I can do. I think I got a pair of blue paradise fish just because I needed fish for the, to eat mosquitoes.
Oh yeah, perfect.
So I just had a bunch of
a
bunch of my random nymphoides that I just had way too many of out there. Mm-hmm. And it did really well for like a month. I sort of had it in partial shade of my tree. And then as the season progressed and as light shifted, all of a sudden it was in full sun most of the day.
Oh, yeah.
And within, I think, a week, algae had bloomed so hard that all of my plants died because it was just way too much light.
Yeah.
It definitely needs to be not full sun for a good portion of the day.
Yeah. So we have this thing in the shop called a par meter. And no, I didn't do this today, but I've done this in the past. And what a par meter does is it measures photosynthetically active radiation, right? Or how good is the light at promoting photosynthesis? If you take that power meter out on a bright sunny day, you can get 3,000 or 4,000 PAR. If you take that into full shade, like go stand under a really big tall oak tree, you're still going to get like 600 or 700 PAR under a big oak tree. Okay, maybe if it's really thick down to 400. Now go stick that under one of our really fancy, awesome twin star lights. 250.
Yeah.
Right? So full on shade is still plenty of light to grow plenty of plants in your pond, and you're going to keep the temperature more stable, which is really what's more important there.
Wait. You mean to tell me that a lot of the fish we want to keep in these tub ponds come from, and plants come from, rainforests?
Crazy. Where there's a canopy?
What?
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, when I was in Costa Rica, I was walking through like dense rainforest that it was, you know, maybe it was noon and you maybe could think about a flashlight, right? And one of the really common house plants is growing all over the forest floor. And it felt dark. And that's where a lot of these fish and these plants come from. So,
yeah, the only environments that I can think of that are like shallow water, full sun environments would be really fast flowing mountain streams and that kind of thing.
True.
And those have tons of algae, and the fish that are in there eat algae.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The temperature swing actually more of a big deal, because all of these ponds are, the pond liners in the containers, most of them are black.
Yeah,
so that black is going to absorb that light and heat that pond up. And you can get those ponds up to 90 to 100 degrees on an 80 degree day.
Yeah, and then when the sun goes down, it'll be probably a pretty sharp dip too.
Drop down to 60 or 50. And
so it's like your fish need to be able to take the cooler temperatures, but mm-hmm. they probably won't be able to handle really warm temperatures.
So that's another really interesting thing about a lot of the fish that we keep, and recognizing what their low temperature range is. How cold do you think platies can go?
My guess is, I don't know, 65 and be really chilly.
I'm picturing like 49, 48 degrees.
Try 37.
You think, really?
That's not, I think, that's, yeah.
You kept them down that low?
So when I collected my last batch of platies, there was snow on the ground and the pond temperature was 35 degrees. At 35, they weren't swimming anymore.
Wow.
Right? At 42, they were fine.
Wow.
Frittata rainbows come from mountain streams. They're usually mm-hmm. collected during the dry season. The dry season on those mountain streams, the temperatures are going to be 75 to 80 degrees, maybe as low as 70. During the wet season on those mountain streams, the temperature can get down to 62 to 65 degrees for frittata rainbow fish.
Yeah, that's,
and there's a lot of fish like that.
Yeah, I've read reports of like Corydoras palliatus being collected from Peruvian streams that had like ice forming on the fringes.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Temperature tolerance for fish is something that we normally don't have to think about. If you keep a 75 to 78 degree tank, that envelops pretty much every fish that we could want to keep in an aquarium.
Yes.
And if you look up, hey, what temperatures can this fish take? You're going to get a pretty limited range of like what temperatures have been measured in the wild. Mm-hmm. We don't experiment a lot with, so what can they really handle?
Right.
Because why would you in an aquarium? This is a great opportunity
and
to do so.
They're going
to
do better at 75 mm-hmm. or some of them 72. They're not going to do great at 45 or 50.
Right. But they'll still be alive,
I guess. But can survive it. The
That's
Danios
so cool.
could take it down to 50 easily.
Right.
Without a problem. They didn't want to go as cold as the platies. Bright red platies at 42 degrees, and they were fine.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yep.
I've seen some people that have ponds that are like wide enough, they'll put parts of them in like kind of a sunny spot and like have the rest of it in the shade. That's why there's a gradient of temperature, and the fish can kind of self-select mm-hmm. where they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you have like an 8-foot wide pond, then go for it, I guess.
Yeah. That brings up another interesting point. Plants. The people that do this the most successfully, that breed the most fish in these ponds, the surface of that pond is almost completely covered in plants. If you look at some of the brighter, sunnier areas where a lot of these fish are found, like look at the banks of some of the bright spots of the Amazon River where the water is slower. Look at any place where fish are found in the sun. It's covered in plants.
True.
Mimic that environment. The roots provide spawning media. The roots provide some food. The roots provide places for bugs to grow on and feed your fish. Plants.
I mean, you almost don't want to be able to see your fish, because if you can, so can other things.
So can predators. Yes.
So can those raccoons we were talking about earlier.
Yes. And it's kind of surprising that to a small guppy, a robin is the thing of nightmares.
Oh, what was that movie? Bug's Life, where they have like the giant bird, like it's Godzilla or something coming in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, perfect.
Exact same thing.
I remember collecting tadpoles as a kid and my mom saying, no, you can't bring them in the house. And of course, you know, we collected tadpoles and we put them in a cake pan, mm-hmm. right? And set it outside in the backyard. And I remember looking out the back window to check and see how the tadpoles are doing. And there were two robins just picking them up like M&Ms.
The best day of their life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Look what somebody set out for us. Man, a bath with a buffet.
Yes, I think to a bird, baby fish are bugs.
Yes. So, yes, lots of plants. So what plants? What plants did you do in yours?
I think I had a bunch of extra dwarf red lilies. That's what I had. Like the Nymphoides. Yeah. I don't know. Does it have a species? Is that Stellatus? That's tiger lilies. Tiger lotus.
Dwarf red has one too, but I don't know what it is.
Petasolata?
That could be right.
Stellata? They are stellata? Okay. The audience says they are. Yeah, right. I think that's what I had in there. And I think I had some Nymphoides to Taiwan, but I think it wanted warmer. I can't remember which one. One of them thrived and one of them didn't. Yeah. And I cannot remember which is which.
What did you do in yours?
Not last year, but the year before that, I tried guppy grass, and it just turned into a hair algae factory, which was fine, because that pond I had Betta Inese.
Ooh.
Oh, nice.
And so they were like, oh, this is great. And I'm like, okay, whatever. I'll leave it. But every other year I've done frog bit.
Oh, frog bit would be perfect.
Yeah.
And multiply like crazy.
Yeah, I'd probably do Sylvania going forward, though, just because I kind of like the little fuzz that it's got.
Oh,
yeah. It just looks cute to me.
Yeah.
I like the dwarf water lettuce because it makes it look like it's like a mini version of a big pond where you'd have, I don't know, probably water hyacinth or whatever other larger floaters that people do.
Just conservation point here because you brought up water lettuce. Water lettuce and water hyacinth both are on Michigan's watch lists. Water hyacinth actually might be on the...
Water hyacinth is like a big bad, I think.
Yeah. I think it might not be allowed to do anymore. Water lettuce is on the watch list.
European frog bit is definitely on the prohibited list, so make sure you have Amazon frog bit.
Yes, and that has to do with the shape of the petiole.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on the European, it's very indented, whereas on the Amazon, it's smoother.
Yeah, and there's going to be no graceful way for us to describe this with just words. So just look up pictures.
Yeah.
But yes, it's distinctive. I'm not a plant person and I can tell the difference. So anyone listening can tell.
Yeah. And we have, in the past 2 years, we've had probably 10 different people bring in, frog bit. And of those 10, three of them were the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Water lettuce, like I said, it's on a watch list. And so if we want to keep having water lettuce be legal in the state of Michigan, don't abuse it.
Yeah, I guess that we need to explain in this podcast what the distinction between the prohibited and the watch list is.
Yeah.
So the prohibited list is a solid, like, you can't have it.
Yeah,
like,
if you are caught with it, you will get in trouble. It won't just be seized. You will get a fine.
And I think the current fine is like $2,000.
Yeah.
If you know that you're breaking the law, If you don't know, you're breaking the law.
Right. If you're aware, and by the way, anybody listening, you now know, then it's a bigger fine.
Yeah.
If you know you're doing something illegal.
That is one of the, like, the scary things about ponds in general to me. It's like anything that you put out, you have to assume is getting into the local ecosystem.
Well, if you are putting it into a contained pond, it shouldn't. I guess, unless, of course,
unless something
flowers
eats
and
it
seeds.
Or it flowers or,
yeah,
you know, yeah, where your goldfish have babies and something eats them and takes them somewhere else or.
Yeah, I don't. Goldfish are pretty hard to get introduced unless somebody like lets them go.
Yeah,
that's how goldfish get introduced.
And at this point, like, that's mostly how they're getting introduced. Yeah. And they're already in pretty much everywhere.
Right. And that, by the way, if you know, if a parent and little Joey say, "Mommy, my goldfish is getting too big. Let's let it go." And parent says, "Yes, let the goldfish go." And they do that. Even if they don't know it's illegal, it's a $2,000 fine.
Yeah.
Yep. So don't do it.
Stop it.
Yeah. But in your contained little backyard garden tub, as long as you're not, you know, on the bank of a river, so every time it flows into the stream. And normal backyards, you're fine. You're good doing this stuff, and it's not going to be a problem.
So then the watch list is, there's precedent for this type of organism or similar organisms to it, either getting established in ecosystems similar to the one we have around here, or so the two situations that are typically happening is, let's say, this species has gotten established in habitats similar to what we have here, or an organism similar to it has gotten established here. And so the watch list is a tentative, we're keeping tabs on it, but it's okay now. So when Ben says, don't abuse it, don't abuse it.
Don't abuse it. And by the way, that's not the government getting its hands in our business. It's idiots ruining it for the rest of us.
It's a few scientists trying to help by telling us what we shouldn't do, because how would we know?
Because too many people are going to not take care of it. No. Because, you know, if so here's like the high horse here, right?
Mm-hmm.
If so, recently the marbled crayfish got outlawed in the state of Michigan. If nobody would have ever let marbled crayfish go, there'd be no reason to outlaw it.
Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it.
Right.
No, my question was, what about the idea of using vals in ponds? Those are native.
Val Americana is native. Want to hear my interesting val story?
Is it telling me I'm wrong?
No, not at all.
Okay, then yes, I want to hear the story.
No. So Valcinaria Americana is the American val, and it is found from southern Canada, I'm pretty sure, down to like Uruguay or maybe even Argentina.
I see it every time I go and look at the Grand River and I want to pull a bunch of it out.
Yeah. I tried. By the way, that's illegal.
You got in trouble?
No, I didn't get in trouble.
Oh.
But I did try to pull some out.
You just admitted to it.
I did.
On a recording.
Yes, but it was longer than 7 years ago.
Statute of limitations.
Exactly. And I'm really sorry. But I tried to grow it in an aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
And it was growing great for me up until about October.
Really?
And then it died back. Which is exactly the time of year it dies back in Michigan.
Plants are so smart.
Yeah. So it knew that the season was going to change and it was supposed to like go into dormant mode. And
well, I guess it would probably need that like temperature trigger to actually get into dormancy. I was going to say, like, did you try and let it hibernate and see what happened?
I'm not nearly that patient.
Well, I guess if you just let it like sit and maybe it would come back or not.
No, because all the plants died. So it tore everything apart.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But if you get a tropical strain, and I suspect, so here's my suspicion, and I think Charles would probably get right on board with this because I know he's a splitter, not a lumper. I think that if the taxonomists eventually get a hold of Valcinaria, it will eventually be split into some different species because of that kind of variation. The lumpers would say, nope.
Yeah, well, the lumpers are wrong.
But the variations definitely behave incredibly differently based on the collection location or the location they're adapted to. Tropical strains of Vale will do fantastic in your local pond. By the way, it is not legal under most circumstances to collect aquatic plants in the state of Michigan. There are some circumstances where it is legal, but you need to contact the DNR for those because I don't want to get anybody in trouble.
Yeah, it's almost like people have been introducing stuff from lakes they're not native to into other lakes mm-hmm. in the state that they're...
It's yeah, ridiculous. Don't put it back and don't try to sell it. Those are the two big ones.
Yeah. You know what I would love to see someone do? I would love to see someone do like emergent growth like crips in like mm-hmm. one of those aquaponic ponds and they have like an inch or two of water.
Yeah, the problem with it is the humidity levels. Crips want really, really humid air. So if the air is too dry and the leaves dry out too much...
I mean, just put a lid on it.
Well, that would work. That would solve that for sure. Yeah, and then it would keep a lot of your predators out too.
Yeah. It would also keep your crips in.
All right, so basic setup we talked about, right? Something that holds water and is big enough for the species you want to keep. Put it in the shade. Put lots of plants in it.
Filtration or not, depending
filtration
on...
Filtration or not, airstone or not. Sometimes just moving that water does help a lot. It
and
cools it.
Plan so that you don't need a heater because it's not going to do you much good at night.
Yeah,
or...
so here's the spiel on heaters with those. Yes, plan on not needing a heater most of the time, but if you do put a heater in it, you add about 6 weeks duration. Mm-hmm. You can put it out a little, about 3 or 4 weeks early. And you can leave it in about 3 or 4 weeks longer, depending on what species of fish and plants you're keeping in the tank.
How much of a change can a heater create? Like, let's say it's 50 degrees at night. How warm could you keep your tank with the appropriately sized aquarium heater for the water volume?
I think it has more to do with watts than anything.
Yeah, like if it's a, I mean, let's say it's a 300 watt heater and a 70 gallon tub, could you rely? I mean, I guess you're not looking to get it to 78 precisely. Yeah. You're just looking at for it to warm up.
The calculations are out there, but I bet it's going to be like 10 to 15 degrees that you're going to get out of it. So if average air temperatures are dropping below 50, you're going to have a hard time getting it to 65.
There ain't no way you're doing this year round. That's what we're saying.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you know, I had a question of somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago, hey, I've got this Dovii cichlid. I know it's going to get big. The only thing I can think to do is to get it a 150 tub pond and try and keep it outside year round. And I told him there's no way any heater is going to let you do that. But at what point can it?
In theory, sure, a heater could do it. But what wattage? The calculations are there.
Yeah,
and
just,
I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. At some point, we'll have to find out what those calculations are. But a 150 isn't big enough for a Dovii.
Yeah. But that was the conversation that we were having. Mm-hmm. And
I respect the person's desire to try and pull it off.
Yeah. But so for our purposes today, let's say don't trust your heater for more than 15 degrees difference.
Yeah. Okay. I'd be cautious. Yeah. More, well, let's, okay, 15.
I know people that keep their house in the, you know, in the low 60s during the winter.
Yep.
And they're fine with an appropriately sized heater.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say 10 degrees and then I thought of that. Yeah. And I was like, oh, 10 to 15. Okay, I guess.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah.
What other equipment could you put on something like this?
That's
we talked about found it. Yeah,
that's all you need.
It's so simple.
But then, you know, start looking at bioload, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you can, so I did see some pretty cool DIY wet dry filters out there made out of a 5 gallon bucket and some volcanic rock.
That's cool.
It was so easy. They took a colander, you turned that into a drip tray.
Yeah.
Or a dollar store container and drilled a bunch of holes in it.
Right.
Boom. There's another drip tray. So the whole idea behind these is doing it really cheap because it's temporary and doing it outside because of sunlight and natural foods. If you can get a good green water culture going in a live bearer system, oh, your live bearer is going to do great. Okay, so a little side project to go right along with these are outdoor Daphnia cultures.
Cool.
And they produce like crazy. Side note, something to pay attention to. If you produce Daphnia like crazy, you also produce mosquito larvae like crazy. be prepared to harvest the mosquito larva a lot.
And maybe consider seeing it as a good thing.
Yeah, if you harvest, it's fine. Otherwise, right. You know, your neighbors might get a little mad about the amount of mosquito
larva
you're producing.
Your mosquito factory in your backyard.
I've seen those done in a cut-off 55-gallon plastic drum. Put water in it and occasionally throw some grass clippings or weeds. No filter. Sometimes in full sun. Let them grow tons of green algae. Feed in the depth. And that's it. The grass clippings slowly decompose and provide all the food the Daphnia need. And you can get some fantastic Daphnia cultures going.
That's cool.
Fast. And then the mosquito larva. Also
mosquito
fantastic
larva's
food. Mosquito
larva is
great
food, right?
It's like great food.
Really good live food.
For pretty much anything but fry. Even adult guppies can take mosquito larva.
Mosquitoes are close enough that like they have to eat them in the wild because I've never seen a betta turn them down in a tank.
When we produced some of those, the amount of things that just devour mosquito larvae is crazy.
During the summer, I'll leave a upturned frisbee just so that mosquitoes will, and then that's, I use it as treats from whenever I go outside every day. If I see some fish food,
they go nuts over it.
Sweet.
Yep.
Should we get more into feeding while we're talking about this?
Yes. So feeding. Almost don't.
Yeah.
Watch your bio load, but the amount of natural foods being produced in that. That when I was producing all of those danios and platies, I never fed those fish. There was plenty of live food being produced in my pond. I fed the koi, but that was koi pellets. Even the biggest platies weren't able to eat the koi pellets. Now, I'm sure there was some dust from that they were going to get on occasion, but I only fed the koi two or three times a week. And that was it.
So maybe like a pinch of flakes weekly just to make sure that the production didn't. Okay.
Yeah. The amount of bugs that will be laying eggs in your little water feature will be insane.
When you say it like that, it sounds so creepy.
Well, you know, but it's good bugs, Amy.
Yeah, that's nice, natural, the way things are supposed to work.
The amount of food being naturally produced. Is that better?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like my bugs in like a brown granule.
I like to think of it as, man, think of all those mosquitoes wasting all their reproductive output.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a question that comes up a lot of times is, what about mosquitoes in your little backyard pond? And they don't stand a chance. You will not get mosquitoes to actually hatch if you have fish in there that eat mosquitoes.
I'm sure in your pond, one made it.
Yeah, but
if it was lucky.
Yeah.
I don't have a mosquito issue in my backyard.
I'm not saying you do. I'm just saying long odds. One has to at some point.
Yes, one also made it in like the thimble of the water in the top of a fence post.
Exactly.
Got him.
Long may he reign.
So that's food.
That's food. I mean, that's covered right there. Oh, by the way, if you do smack it, just flick it right back in. And,
mm-hmm. and watch it get eaten. Yeah. It's very satisfying, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did do actually some research online on this and looked for some funny anecdotes with this project. And there was somebody who said, yeah, they put a bug zapper above their pond so that the bzz, right? And they'd fall into the pond. The amount of dead bugs that didn't get eaten was surprising. And if you think of what a bug zapper does, it instantly takes a live insect and turns it into charcoal.
Yeah.
Right. So there was zero nutritional value left in those zapped bugs into the pond. So the point of that little anecdote was, yeah, don't do that.
Fish don't eat ash.
Ash is essentially what, yeah. That's what they were turning into, was ash. But you won't need to do that because your little water feature will attract enough of those bugs and you'll hear this bloop. And that'd be the wonderful little sound of a small insect eating fish in your pond, taking one from the surface.
I like to think of it as insect has just met his maker.
Exactly.
All right. Yep. Well, can I keep rolling on questions then?
Keep rolling.
Because we're talking about maintenance now. Yeah. What about everybody's favorite subject? Water changes.
God does them.
That's sort of the answer I was expecting.
Rain, if you have a particularly dry year, you might need to do some water changes on your pond. And the way that you'll know is by evaporation. If you never have to top your little pond off, and it's open, if it's got some kind of a cover on it, obviously it's not going to evaporate. But if it is open to the air and you never have to top it off, rain is doing all the water changes that little pond is going to need.
So like in an enclosed tub, are we like letting it overflow?
Yeah, most of the time it'll overflow.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's okay. But it won't overflow dramatically.
Right.
If you have to top off your little pond, do a little water change.
Okay.
Yep, because it's not getting enough turnover. But the amount of nutrients that if you've got good plant growth, there's not going to be any nitrates in there. There's not going to be any ammonium in there to turn into nitrate to nitrate. We're not worried about mineralization that we would in a saltwater aquarium.
Right.
Right. We're only really worried about the processing of waste.
Yeah.
Plants are going to handle that. As long as there's at least a little bit of good fresh water being added to the tank, and rainwater will do it.
Yeah. And the volume of what you're usually working with is, like, if you were to do a little platy colony, you're probably talking about a 29-gallon tank. If you were to set up an equivalently, like, spaced tub, it's probably more like 50 or 100 gallons.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So waste management, not that big of a deal.
Not a concern. Yeah. You know, maybe plan on doing a water change once a month, which over the course of a summer, that's three.
Yeah.
And if you miss one, you're probably good. If it gets a little dry, do a water change.
Okay.
August, late July, the big June showers, don't worry about it.
What else? We're not following your...
Oh, problems, issues, challenges.
Yeah, because I was just going to ask. Yeah, we've hinted at them.
Yeah.
So what do you do if your pond's on fire?
Call an exorcist.
Are you talking about my pond is on fire? Or are you saying like actual there's something burning?
I don't know. I just picture like you walk out there and
you
the
move
surface
out of
your,
Ohio.
Yeah, yeah. The surface of your pond is just on fire. You're like, wow, what did I do?
I think you should probably lay off the weed.
Maybe
time to cut back.
What was the line
Michigan
you gave
here.
Me?
I don't know what you expect.
Yeah.
Well, you gave me this line like 2 years ago where it was like, if something
have
that,
you met me?
If something this bad happens, you should get a different hobby. But you had a specific hobby lined up in
oh,
that.
Oh, buy a stereo.
There you go.
Yeah.
Buy a stereo and go to truck driving school.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so the biggest challenge people run into is temperature swings and algae based on sunlight. Mm-hmm. Put them in the shade. And remember that over from between June and August, that sun is going to change its position. So it may be shady during one part of the summer, but not during the rest of the summer.
Yep.
Look at umbrellas, look at some kind of shade cloth if that becomes an issue. But sunlight is the biggest challenge. Pest control. Dragonfly larvae are a concern.
Those things are spooky.
They are spooky. They're impressive
like
predators.
Little alien monsters.
Yeah. Yes. Some of them will even bite you.
In Russia, bug bites.
The solution to dragonfly larvae? Bigger predators.
There you go. So would you recommend in a colony of like, I don't know, a dozen cherry barbs, adding something bigger?
Well, that ends up being counterproductive.
Right.
Right. So if you get dragonfly larvae in there, it's probably going to be mid towards end of season. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it might be time to get your cherry barbs and the fry out of there and then put a predator in there like a pike cichlid or even a geophagus will take out, you know, and those could be great in ponds.
You know, or for the cheap among you, a 3-spot gourami. Would that do it? How big do you need to go?
I mean, have you seen some dragonfly larvas? You can get some that are in the 1.5-inch range. So, okay. Pictus cats.
Oh yeah,
would be perfect.
That's a good common cheap one too. Yeah.
Yeah, those would probably take care of dragonfly larvae in short order.
there's always a bigger fish.
Exactly.
What about the bigger, scarier predators?
Raccoons. Raccoons are a challenge. The inability for the raccoons to see the fish helps. But I've seen people have to come up with solutions of like chicken wire or getting some unsightly things. Wire screen, chicken wire, mesh, something that can really protect it from those kinds of predators.
I had a buddy growing up where he set up a pond and one morning he woke up and there was a heron digging around in there.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern.
And I was like, I don't have a solution to that.
So a surprising solution for herons and raccoons that really works well is to run like some 20 or 30 pound test fishing line strategically around it. That for the heron particularly, with a heron, maybe you want like some 30 or 40 pound, but the heron trips over it and it freaks it out and flies away because it tripped over something that it can't see.
Right? Seems like a much nicer alternative to like the big nets I see people put over their ponds.
Right.
And for a little pond, like putting a big net over something that a heron could just easily reach into anyway is not going to help that much.
Right. Herons on ponds are a big deal. We actually, in one pond that I worked on for a while, we had a plastic heron that we put next to the pond, and it worked. We did not ever have herons, and we had herons fly over, but they never landed in the pond. And that was full of some big, beautiful koi that herons would think of as some tasty treats. I've also heard stories of herons landing next to koi ponds with big, huge koi that they can't eat, and they try anyway and leave them on the beach. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yes. Those are kind of the big ones, though. Pay attention to raccoons. Make it so they can't see them. Put it up a little higher. If there's nothing for the raccoon to stand on and reach in, it's really hard for it to do that. Raccoons are kind of clumsy. So they need a good solid place to stand to reach into your pond. That's why something dug in the ground can sometimes be, the raccoon can take its time.
And they like the water, but they don't really like to swim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. I have coons that mess with my pond all the time because we've got a big one that lives in our garage. Mm-hmm. But he's never gotten my koi because the koi just go down deep and they won't swim.
I would think having things a little closer to your house too, if you're just setting up a temporary container, a heron's not going to go right up next to a human house. Right. Raccoon, they will.
That's another advantage to having your ponds in the shade or your tubs in the shade. Shade, so herons they find water features by flying over and looking for them. So if it's shaded, if there's trees covering the water, they're less likely to see that and know that there's actually a food source there. Yeah. So while we're on the topic of like temperature and light and things like that, I know not everyone listening is from Michigan or even from northern climates. And if you are from tropical climates, you don't have to take it down at the end of the season.
Right.
I did see a really cool video of a guy whose entire fish room is outside. And he's in Florida. It's all nicely shaded. He's in a very jungly type area, which there are those in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It's all nicely shaded. They get some major rainstorms there. He doesn't do water changes. He barely feeds.
Wow.
It's actually just aquariums, but he's got it set up so that, you know, when it rains, sometimes when it rains really big, he finds some fish on the floor. But not very often. And he enters swords in a lot of the competitions,
mm-hmm.
and almost always wins. Sword tails.
I believe it.
Almost always wins. He has some of the best sword tails in the hobby.
Yeah. So
year-round outdoor.
Things aren't going to freeze over in the winter. Do you have to be even more concerned about invasives and that kind of thing?
Well, you know, that's the thing about Florida, right? That it is now just overrun with invasive species all over the place. So it's definitely something that you have to be very, very aware of.
I think last I looked, there was 40 species with established populations. That's not 40 as in like they've seen it, as in it's breeding and sticking around.
Yeah, Oscars are now considered a game fish in Florida.
Yeah.
Right.
But wholesalers keep their fish in ponds down there, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just what they do.
One of the best places to go collecting in the whole world is in the ditches around the wholesalers. Because of the bite of fish. And, you know, it's Florida, so it's already messed up anyway.
Florida.
I don't really mean that. We should be careful in Florida, too, but jeez.
Yeah, it sometimes feels like that ship has sailed.
It's kind of hopeless down there. Although the really cold temperatures we had not too long ago, I think it was this season or the season before, where it like actually snowed down in Fort Myers. It helped.
I bet.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, okay, the fun stuff, right?
Yeah, we talked about care. We talked about the drudgery. We talked about what to be afraid of, what not to do.
So what fish should you put in your outdoor pond?
What fish shouldn't you put in your outdoor pond?
That's the thing. The ones you like, that's the one that you should put out there. I mean,
in the past, I've typically worked with mouth-brooding bettas out in my ponds. But this year, I'm going to try and change my game a little bit, and I'm going to try a bubble nesting species.
I think in Michigan, any fish that can handle temperatures in the low 70s as a low, do it. So I don't know that I would do discus, but put a heater out there and see what happens.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
To me, tub ponds are a great opportunity to work with some of the fish that might be otherwise a little bit more work to breed, mm-hmm. which to me is the egg scatterers. And not True. More work. They're not more work to spawn, but to raise. They're True. Typically a little bit more difficult. They're not going to exhibit parental care. The babies are going to be born or going to hatch smaller. So like to throw a dozen of something that you think is cool and let them do their thing and still maybe get babies is really appealing.
There's an interesting experiment that I read about. We're going back like probably 15 years that I read about it, and I've never tried it. But cardinal tetras are one of those fish that they're extremely challenging for the average hobbyist to breed in captivity. There's just something about those things. The conditions have to be just right for cardinal tetras to breed. It has a lot to do that in nature, they're really a seasonal fish. And so setting up those conditions in an aquarium is tough. But what this person did is he waited for the hottest part of the summer, right? And we're talking regular temperatures in the upper 80s to low 90s. And it was like a 10-day experiment.
Mm-hmm.
On day one, filled a 5-gallon bucket with RO water and then put just a ton of Oakleys in it. Day two, another 5-gallon bucket set up the same way. Day three, day four, day five. Day six, put 6 cardinal tetras in the first bucket. Day seven, move those 6 cardinal tetras into the next bucket. Day eight, move those. And by the way, these buckets are all kept in the shade, in the shadiest part, but the hottest days. Boom, baby cardinal tetras.
Wow.
Now, this was, like I said, I read about somebody doing this once. I've never tried it. Somebody out there's got to try it. You need heat, and you need stagnant water, and you need tannins. Cardinal tetra eggs are light sensitive. So that's why you need the oak leaves, not just as shade, but also the breaking down of the tannins in the water to produce the darkness that those eggs need.
That's so cool.
I know. Somebody's got to try it.
I love the idea of taking advantage of the seasons for more short-term projects like that.
Yeah, it was a 10-day project.
Yeah.
You probably could start it even earlier, you know, get the oaks going much sooner than that and do it for 2 days, only make sure you got plenty of tannins in the water. But the pH at that point, what do you think, Charles? It's going to get down to 4.5, 5?
Probably around 5.5, 5 range.
Yeah, in 5 days, solid oak leaves.
Yeah, if you're jamming him in there, you can probably get it pretty low.
Yeah. The description was thick with oak leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not just putting like 5 oak leaves in a 5-gallon bucket. Like fill the bucket a quarter of the way up with oak leaves and then.
Are we doing brainstorming now? Is that what we're on?
Yeah.
What about if those same 5-gallon buckets, 6 or 8 licorice crummies?
probably would work.
Like, they're so tricky to breed because of feeding, because of getting the acidic water, because of all those things. I wonder if that would be worth it to try.
It'd probably have to be longer term, though, just because they are a little bit more. They do show some parental care and have some pair bonding.
Yeah,
but
like, if you started that in June and did the full season with licorice grommies, I wonder what you could get.
What's the temperature range for licorice grommies?
The literature says like 70 to like 84 degrees. So
they can get up there.
Yeah. I can imagine them doing okay in some, because like even in like these rainforests, they do get down a little bit in at night, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's some of the challenging choices.
We always have so many
choices.
Licorice grommies on our lists, too. Yeah.
Easy choices. Let's say with the 20-gallon round pond, we're going to set it up with a sponge filter. We're going to put a bunch of hornwort in it, and we're going to put a bunch of frog bit in it. So the surface is almost completely covered with frog bit, hornwort in the bottom of it, a group of guppies going to go crazy in something like that. Endlers going to go crazy in something like that. Any of the rice fish.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people, that's how they breed a lot of Cory cats.
Cory cats should do great like that.
Any Hyphasabrachon tetra, right? Pretty much. At least of the most common ones, like serpes.
The common ones,
lemons,
probably would, yeah.
Diamonds.
Orange flames. Those aren't Hyphasabrachons.
I don't care. They do great
in
that.
but yes, any of them, like common tetras, I would say.
So then
common deep-bodied tetras.
Instead of doing frog bit, switch to water lettuce, where you've got those big, long, drapey roots, and now rainbows. And in those 20-gallon tubs, any of the pseudomugles, probably the Erythrina, Wernerii. The threadfins. I don't know that one specifically if it would work, but probably.
Neon
dwarfs would probably do great. Go up to your 100-gallon tub, set up the same way with a bunch of mops, and go crazy with any of the big rainbows.
Yeah, like Bosmani, the Irian reds, the turquoise. Those would all be really
yellows,
cool.
Yes.
And they'd look really cool,
they
too.
They would look amazing. At the end of the season, you would pull out the most beautiful rainbow fish you've ever seen in your life.
I've done mouth-brooding bettas.
Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend that you put a cover on any pond that you do that in.
Yes, jumpers.
My solution was the metal grating, and then I just bent the corners so it was like it could fit over a round tub.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that would be perfect.
Yeah.
Yep.
Easy enough.
These ponds are about innovation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're growing aquatic plants in some kind of water thing, put fish in there and they will make more.
Yeah. This took us a long time to say.
Yeah. That's kind of the gist.
I would love to hear what projects other people have going on this summer.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite like things to hear people talk about, because you're right. It is all innovation. In aquariums, there are so many established ways to do things.
Right.
This is a little bit of like the Wild West of aquariums.
Yeah.
In the best possible way. It's like you and whatever problem you're trying to solve, whatever fish that you want to make perfect, whatever really cool thing you want to make more of.
Yeah. And it should work. Put some baseball and tennis ball size rocks in there and do cichlids or plecos, or put some pleco caves in there and do plecos.
Plecos is a good idea.
Yeah. These things with a little bit of extra light should grow tons of algae. Put some driftwood in there for the wood eating plecos. They should go crazy.
The look of a pair of cichlids and like a swarm of fry around them from above is pretty cool.
It's very cool. I mean, that's kind of it, right? That's the basics.
Mm-hmm.
Something that holds water.
Something that holds water, plants, and fish.
That's it.
Yeah.
In the shade.
In the shade.
Can I emphasize even more in the shade? Right? It feels like we want to put these where they're going to get some good sunlight. You're going to burn your plants and cook your fish. It'll be too much light for most aquatic plants if it's in direct sunlight.
Yeah.
And then it will evaporate like crazy, and you will need to do some major water changes on it.
Yeah, keep it close-ish to your water source. Make sure you're planning that ahead. Yeah. These are heavy. Once you get them in place...
You are not moving them.
Until you're done.
Right.
So do some, do a little bit of planning on the front side and let it go. So what are you working on this summer?
Yeah, what are some of the fun projects out there that somebody's doing? I want to hear about them. Yeah. What are some... I want to hear... Somebody list 5 fish they succeeded with and 3 they failed with. Yeah, I tried these and they did not work.
Yeah, I'm almost more interested by your failures than your successes, especially on this subject.
What would be really cool is if we get somebody that had, yep, I couldn't get these to work, and somebody that said, hey, these worked for me, and then like connect them and those two maybe can try to figure out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole thing.
That's cool. Called science.
Sweet. I mean, sort of, yeah. So make sure to check us out on Facebook. We'll make a post of this episode there, and I would love to hear your ideas. You can always email us at podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com as well. I've really been enjoying the feedback and messages we've been getting lately. People have been sending us articles. People have been sharing pictures of their projects. We love it. Please keep doing that.
Yeah, we do read those. Like today we got a like a email or something.
Yeah, it was an email of this really cool article about betta genetics that I had never heard any of that information before.
That was pretty amazing.
It was really cool. So yeah. I love getting those. Please keep sending them.
Shout out to the guy who did the Aponogeton project.
Yes.
He was doing the project based on information from what I did. He did it way better than I did.
And he showed us pictures of it, too.
That was fantastic. I absolutely loved it. Nice job.
Please. I love hearing about it.
Well, this sounds like lots of fun. I might even have to try one of these outside again this year. It's been a few years.
Yeah, I'm a little tempted to, honestly.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to have lots of fun with this topic. I hope you have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.